Hello and welcome to the fifth season of Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name's Lewis Webb and we're back with brand new weekly episodes where I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. Since announcing this season on social media, I've had a lot of really nice comments from listeners and all your feedback is always appreciated. So if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week grew up visiting grandparents in the shadow of Cadbury Castle and developed a lifelong connection with the area. Sarah Darbo has a life story which covers everything from TV production, travel in East Africa and working with local cheesemakers. She is now settled in Frome, where she's the founder of Acre & Holt, a tweed work and gardenware business which puts its emphasis on sustainability and British production. Zara and I spoke in June of 2022, so there may be a few references that are a little dated. Even so, with so much to cover, there should be something for everyone in what made for a wide-ranging conversation. Zara, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
We're recording this at the start of Glastonbury Week. Are you going to be at the festival this week?
I will be. We go every year because my other half is actually involved in the Speakers Forum, which is in the Green Futures field. So he runs a cafe, puts on a debating tent, and I go in with our daughter Annie on Friday.
Delightful. This won't be produced before the weekend. I'm not going to have time to edit it and put it out in advance of Glastonbury, but what are you looking forward to most?
Gosh, it's I find that actually often with Glastonbury, especially now with a family and also the cafe and talks and things, it's so good just never really to plan anything, and you just go in with a completely open mind and see where you end up. I discovered an amazing band in 2019, the last one, who were just playing near us, called the Oddbeats, who were an extraordinary mix of Turkish virtuoso violinists and fiddlers, but who play everything against the beat. And I started following them on Facebook, and I'm really pleased to discover that they're actually going to be playing again. They're coming back to Glastonbury this year, so I'm going to make a point of trying to track down the Oddbeats.
Awesome. We were talking just before recording, actually, that you used to live around the corner from where I am now, but you're currently based in Frome. You've had enough time there now to sort of uncover the full delights of the town. What are some of your sort of favourite hidden gems in the neighbourhood?
Frome it's an amazing place, as I'm sure everyone's rather tired of hearing, but it is a place that is full of extraordinary little cut-throughs and passageways and secret paths that cut between streets. Snickets, I think they're called in some parts of the country. But you never tire of walking around and just finding these little places. And also just the architecture here is incredible. It was such a busy, important town in the early 18th century. I think that it has these extraordinary town buildings that were big merchants, wool merchants, houses. And because there's never really been much development here, they are still pretty much untouched. And so you stumble across extraordinary architecture and all these lovely little cut-throughs everywhere.
So it's just a place to kind of wander and get lost for you?
Slightly. And yet there is also just, there's a great sense of community here. There's a wonderful setup now down by the railway station. We've got a big open air car park. Well, it's a car park that has been colonized now by one shipping container that's got a South Indian food hub in it, and then you've got the Rye Bakery set up next door and Hesperian Fish Bar. And it really came into its own over lockdown because this open air car park just became a focal point for lots of people to gather on Friday nights and they could all be outside. They could have pizzas from their pizza oven, or you could order any food from all of these different food setups. And it was just somewhere for people to meet. And it would become also for the Rye Bakery, they started supplying more different types of food. So they were getting meat coming in from local farms, they were getting butter, milk. And so it became a pickup point for people to get food. And it's carried on since lockdown stopped. It's still buzzing on the weekends and the evenings. So that's a good spot to check out.
And also just around the corner, there's the reclamation place as well, which I love. I can just kind of wander and look at their fireplaces for hours because they have so many of them.
They do. I remember trying to find doors actually for the house in Ditchet, which is where I used to live. But I remember spending hours trying to find doors, and you sort of get blind to it all because the more you look at them, you then kind of get lost into which one might work. So spending a lot of time studying different types of doors there.
Speaking of doors, there was also, I know there's a rather good auction house in Frome as well, that I think they've got a good interiors thing coming up, which again, like, just is full of furniture that I don't need. But looking at the catalogue is always really interesting.
Oh, I think also you get so many good characters there when you go to the auctions, and it's a great auction house, and you do get tempted by incredible bargains, but you do see the same people who come back. I think they have two a month, but there's definitely good people watching going on there. And then also there's the auctions out at by Mole Valley. There, Cooper and Tanner do house auctions, although at Standerwick, but I don't know if they still do them. But if you like bargain hunting and auctions, there's a lot of car boot sales too around. So
that's true.
They're good to go to.
You've been living in Somerset for over 20 years, but you grew up outside of the county, didn't you?
I grew up in London, but I'm actually, my grandparents did live in Somerset. So I used to come even as a kid. They lived in Chelton Musgrove when I was quite small. And then when I was probably a teenager, they moved to North Cadbury. So I always loved being in Somerset, coming to visit them. And I would come down as a student, supposedly revising, spending time with them in North Cadbury then, but in fact, spending most of my revision time walking great distances across the hills there around Cadbury Castle, but then also going towards Sherburn, the big ridges there by Courton Denham. Anyway, I got to know that bit of land very, very well. Maybe not quite my studies. Well, my studies maybe didn't go quite so well either, because I was so distracted by just endlessly wanting to go walk more across the hills.
Was that maybe because you didn't have that type of landscape in London? You just sort of wanted the freedom of open fields and hills?
I'm sure. Yes, I just loved being out in it and loved becoming more and more familiar with it and seeing the landscape from different vantage points and getting to know places like Yarlington and Galhampton, that whole valley, really well. And it certainly did make a big difference from London. And I think Cadbury Castle was just always a really special place for me. I climbed it in the middle of the night when my grandfather was dying. I dragged my cousin up there, just going, come on, let's go and walk up to the top of the hill and, you know, send some words of love up to him. And she hated walking at the best of times. Couldn't believe that I actually managed to persuade her to come walking up there with me at sort of 11 o'clock at night. It always had a resonance for me. And then I actually met my partner at the bottom of it years later, but his sister lives in a house at the bottom of Cadbury Castle, which again, I think she'd moved into years later. She had a party and he was there and we met for the first time under that hill. So I feel that hill has a very special role in my life for me.
That's fantastic. Yeah, we did manage to get our two little ones up to the top. Last year, I think it was. Yeah, there might have been a little bit of carrying on shoulders at some point, but yeah, I mean, the views for one, even if it doesn't have that kind of the even if there's no sentimental feeling behind it, it's still an amazing place to be.
Yes, it is, and you can see the weather change so much. We went up there at Christmas, the lockdown Christmas, the second one, and met my aunt who lives on the other side of the castle. So she lives in a hamlet on the other side, and we all walked up from our different sides and met on the top, and we literally had hailstones, rain, rainbows, bright sunshine, and quite a busy wind, but all within the space of the half hour that we were up there together on the top of the hill. But it's a good vantage point to be able to see all around.
Was that outdoorsy streak encouraged by your parents while you were growing up? What did they do?
I do remember when we were little kids and staying where my grandparents used to live in Charlton Musgrove, and there would always be this thing about having to go and walk down the lane before we were allowed to have lunch. And that would sort of not mean sort of trudging down the lane towards the racecourse at Wincanton. And, you know, being dragged, kicking, and, well, maybe not screaming, but, you know, definitely not really relishing the prospect of another walk before lunch or after lunch. But actually, my brother and I, we just used to spend hours off in the fields. My grandfather was a dairy farmer, and so there was a barn, and there was some old sheds and milking parlour, and we just used to keep ourselves busy for hours just tinkering around, finding old bits of metal that we'd be sort of hammering into shape, making our own little workshop, sort of a Vulcan's forge or something in this dairy yard. But I've always loved being outside. I think, yeah, my mum, she worked in London, but she did. She's always enjoyed being quite outdoorsy too. I mean, she's nearly 80, but she still marches around the streets of London doing her 10,000 steps every day. So maybe that left its mark on me.
Aside from loving all of the sort of exploring and adventuring, did you have ambitions to sort of go into your grandfather's business and, you know, go into farming, going into agriculture? What did you want to be growing up?
No, I didn't want to be a farmer, I don't think. I don't really remember what I would have wanted to be when I was young. I do recall, though, whenever I used to come down and visit them when I was a bit older, always leafing through the Blackmore Vale magazine, looking wistfully at the lettings bit at the back of it, going, oh, maybe I'll just come and just try and get a little, you know, come and rent a little place down here. And that was probably when I was in my 20s. So I kind of had this hankering, I think, always to get back to Somerset. I went off on a bit of a curveball and went to Africa for about 10 years before getting here. And I think maybe being out there as well, that just gave me a real love of the big open spaces, big skies. And so when I came back, definitely being back in London, I felt quite hemmed in, and it was like, actually, no, come on, let's make this work. Let's get out while I can.
I do want to revisit your time in East Africa a little bit. But firstly, just a couple of questions around your time as a student. You studied languages. What do you recall most about your time at Oxford?
Gosh, lots of plays, lots of drama is what I probably spent more than maybe I should have been doing, or I spent time doing that. It was an extraordinary time. It was quite an active time, actually, politically. I suppose it was, there was a lot of student demos for things like the poll tax, student grants. There's a lot of anti-apartheid stuff. We were quite active in marching and demonstrating and certainly the Africa connection became quite strong then because of all the disinvestment that was going on, Rock Against Racism. We used to go to the Africa Centre in Covent Garden a lot. And I had quite a few friends who were South Africans, but living in exile over here. It was definitely the passion that was driving a lot of us to march and demonstrate about things then.
Yeah, sort of peak Thatcherism time as well. So yeah, a lot of discontent at home and abroad.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, now looking back on it, we were so lucky. You know, we had grants and we got support to go and do our studies, and tuition was free. And nowadays, I feel amazed for young people that they have to make some pretty big choices very early on in their lives about the routes they want to take and how committed they want to be to be spending that sort of money on degrees, when it's hard to know quite where it's going to take them afterwards, or what value they're getting for their money.
You mentioned Africa and your time there. What took you there, and what can you tell me about your time? I know it was 10 years, but maybe just sort of some edited highlights.
Well, like I mentioned, when we were, as students, we were quite involved with South Africans in exile over here, and it fostered a real love of Africa. And I took part in a drama tour. We went to Kenya in our second year and performed around Kenya for 2 months, which really gave me a love of East Africa. And a few years afterwards, my boyfriend was posted out there as a journalist, my boyfriend at the time. And he and I had gone there together beforehand. And so he asked if I would go with him, and I was just finished working on a project in London and said, oh, come on, let's do it. So off we went. He was a journalist, and it was just at the time that the war in Somalia was beginning to get fairly fierce. So he was in Somalia quite a bit of the time, and I moved out to Nairobi, and then we stayed there, and both of us then started working. I'd already been working in television in London doing documentaries, and I started working more on news and current affairs stuff while I was out in Kenya, and eventually ended up running the bureau for German TV called ZDF, is a broadcaster in Germany who had a permanent bureau in Nairobi, and I was their producer. So traveling a lot around East and West Africa. So I spent a lot of time in Uganda, Ethiopia, Eritrea. Eritrea is, Asmara is the most beautiful city. If anyone ever gets the chance to go there, the whole thing feels like a 50s film set with little Fiat 100s or Fiat 500s or Fiat 1000s driving around. It was taken over by Mussolini. It was part of the Abyssinian Empire. But the whole place is covered in coffee shops with zinc bar tops and old 50s barber's equipment. So the cafes and the barbers still feel like they're something straight out of Cinecittà, some Italian 50s set. But yeah, it was an extraordinary time, and I was really lucky to travel a lot. I mean, going to music festivals or voodoo festivals in Benin, covering a fair amount of war as well. I spent a lot of time in Kinshasa, which was in Zaire then, that's DRC. But when Mobutu, who was a larger than life character, finally fled his country that he'd pretty much bled dry for the previous 30 years, that was a time that I was in Kinshasa with a lot of the press corps, and we had rebels coming from East Africa who'd walked all the way from Rwanda, most of them young boys in flip-flops, but they'd marched thousands of miles across the rainforest and the rivers to get to Kinshasa and take the city, which felt a bit like being in Paris, the liberation of Paris in 1945. It was an extraordinary time to be there then. Sadly, I think the rebel leaders didn't quite live up to their promise. And unfortunately, I think a lot of the poor people in DRC are probably in the same situation that they were then. I can't say that the leaders have changed or altered their fortunes that much.
After, you know, a number of different adventures, different sort of bits of the TV career, you ended up being able to sort of live out that early childhood or sort of young adult wish of wanting to find yourself living in Somerset. How did that happen? What brought you here initially?
Well, it was, yeah, amazing, fortuitous encounters with a couple. When I got back, I came back from Kenya and was living in London, making documentaries and working with a dear friend in London who then actually she moved out to live in Kenya. But whilst we were in London, we met a couple who just moved to Bruton, and they had an organic dairy farm, and they were just beginning to get a cheese made using some of their milk. And I had, in a previous life, been a buyer for Marks and Spencer's before I went off to Africa. So I said, well, look, I'll come and help you get the cheese going. You know, I love a bit of cheese and love a bit of market trading, and let's see what we can do. So originally I was going to come down and just work a few days a week, but pretty swiftly it became quite a full-time job. And I spent 6 years at Godminster, which has now become stocked in most supermarkets, I think. But it is an extraordinary cheese, or extraordinarily popular cheese. And for the first few years, we were literally doing the farmers markets in Wincanton, in Castle Carey, Sherburn. I had sort of people doing them up in London too. It was in the early 2000s. So it was just as farmers markets and the organic food industry was beginning to take off in the UK. And the interest in provenance and food became a lot more important. So my passport out of London was actually cheddar cheese. And it was a great world to be involved in, because I was fully immersed in deep Somerset stuff, working with Wyke Farms, the wonderful Nigel Pooley, who's the nose of Wyke Farms cheese operation. And he and I would go off and grade vats of cheddar together. And this was all based, as I said, in Bruton, which was down the road from where my grandparents had lived and was a place that I'd known as a kid. So I was right back in the hub of where I remembered. I was, you know, Alfred's Tower was a place I can still remember having kids' picnics at when I was small. And I then moved, when I first worked at Godminster, I lived in Hardway, rented a cottage in Hardway, sort of right under the shadow of Alfred's Tower, and found myself back looking at it, you know, walking up there and enjoying being underneath it once more, and sort of really feeling I'd reconnected back into the Somerset dream.
Aside from having the family dairy farming connections, did you know anything about cheese before you took that role?
No, I'd learned a lot on the job, but you know, the actual cheese making was being done by Wyke, and you know, they are fully immersed and they are families, family of cheesemakers who have been making cheddar for 200 years or more. So I was learning from them, and it was fascinating. I did then become really obsessed about cheese, because they, you know, at that time, then suddenly there were so many other people making small artisan producers, whether it's goat's cheese, soft goat's cheese, hard goat's cheese, sheep's cheese, then some really extraordinary full fat English cow's cheeses. There were more independent cheesemakers in Britain than there were in France, which would stun people, but actually that world became a real buzzy world of food enthusiasts, and a lot of whom are based, you know, within a 10-mile radius of where you're sitting right now.
Do you ever get tired of it? Do you get sort of all cheesed out?
I think I probably, by the time I'd done about 6 or 7 years and it had become a much bigger operation, I think I then probably decided I'd done enough time in cheese. I did have quite a funny time though once when I remember finding a guy. I got this phone call once in the office, and also I met someone at a show, and they was like, "Oh my goodness, this is the cheese. There's some guy, there's a comedian who's doing a show about your cheese." I was like, "What were you talking about?" And I put two and two together and realized that they were talking about somebody who'd been on a show at the Comedy Store, and I cross-referenced the dates and found the guy, who the name of the person that they were obviously referring to. And so I checked out his name, and I don't know whether you would have had a web page by then. I was just trying to think, how long ago was it? But he was coming down to play at the Little Theatre in Wells. Is it the Little Theatre Club in Wells? About a month later or something. So I called up a friend of mine who used to come and work at some of the shows and doing the cheese with me, and said, come on, this comedian's coming to Wales. We've got to go and see him. Apparently he's doing a whole skit about the cheese. And so off we went, and I took a little cheese in my bag just in case he did strike gold. And sure enough, this comedian came on and he was doing his bit. And then suddenly he started going on about this cheese he'd discovered, which is like, it was crack. It was the crack of cheese. And sure enough, it was a whole skit he was doing about Godminster that was basically so addictive he was comparing it to being just like crack. We gave him his cheese to say thank you at the end of the evening, but it's a lovely thing to make people so happy with something, especially when it's food.
We've been talking for over half an hour and haven't mentioned Tweed. So it's probably a good idea to start. We should probably talk about Tweed. Otherwise your PR person's not going to be very excited, not going to be very happy at all. What do you know about the heritage of just Tweed as a material? Are you much of a historian into the kind of provenance of it?
It is obviously woven in Scotland. It was supposedly a mispronunciation of twill that had come from, you know, on a bolt of fabric. The label somebody wrote, or they were counting the fabric out. I mean, this I think is in the 18th century or 17th century in London, and somebody was taking dictation, and instead of writing twill, they misunderstood and wrote tweed. But because it obviously comes from by the River Tweed, and that's how it became known. It's just fabulous fabric that I have loved since being a kid. I mean, you know, one of my grandparents lived in Scotland. We'd go up there quite a bit as kids. We would be dressed in quite scratchy tweed sometimes, but it was always something that whenever I went back, I'd be in awe of the colours, the way people would use the landscape around them to inspire and be reflected in the weaves of their tweed. The provenance of it, I mean, there are extraordinary stories about how ways of curing the wool that was used in the tweed that, I mean, this is slightly unpleasant, but they used to fix it by peeing on it. And so urine is something that was used to fix the dyes in the wool. So things like the House of Lords on a wet day in 1910 or something, would the aroma of slightly stale pee would just start rising from damp bodies if it had been pouring with rain in central London, and these people would all have come in for their votes. That it wouldn't be that aromatic. Thankfully, these days they don't rely on the same fixing agents. Yeah.
Is there much of a history of, obviously not the kind of the weaving, but tweed as a production or sort of design of it in this area at all?
Well, there is a mill. There's a mill. I mean, even now there's currently a mill at Fox Brothers, which is near Wellington.
Ah, yes, of course.
But yeah. Froome's money was all from wool. So it was a massive wool town in the 15th, 16th centuries. And there were weavers' cottages. That's what a lot of the houses are here, with quite steep pitched roofs, very high attic ceilings, because all the yarns would be wound over the rafters. But there's also lots of rivers here, because they were dyeing the wool here as well. Woad grows outside Froome. So a lot of the uniforms, the uniforms for the British and the French army, because they both used to wear blue uniforms, was actually dyed here in around Froome. So there is a big history of it here, but actually, yeah, we work with a mill in the Scottish borders. So I've been working with this mill up in Selkirk for the last nearly 10 years. It's an old family-run mill in a very beautiful, it's a very old building. It's 200 years old, the mill. But it's surrounded by derelict buildings, which I think, sadly, nobody's really got the money or the resources to start restoring. And it's been a recurring theme so much of this journey that we've been on with developing the tweed and the making clothes back here in the UK, is how much of the industry is struggling to survive, because so much of it was neglected in the 80s and 90s, and manufacturing is struggling and it's hard to bring it back, because we've all got used to buying things quite cheaply. And actually, if you're buying stuff that's made here or made ethically pretty much anywhere, but it's not going to cost what you're finding on your high streets at the moment. But anyway, so these mills that are up there, I mean, it's surrounded by this slightly derelict work spaces. It's wonderful that they are keeping on going. And actually, the mill itself is busy, and they have woven stuff for Matt Smith's Doctor Who. They have woven stuff. I mean, I think they still weave for Prince Charles, but they also are one of the historical tartan weavers. So they have an archive of all the old tartans, as well as a lot of tweeds. And yet they're still able to make on fairly small scale, so that we can work together and they can weave bolts of 30 meters, 40 meters of tweeds that we're designing. So that gives us an opportunity to make our own mark on things.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a couple of things just in that. You mentioned Prince Charles. You mentioned kind of the military as a material. And you also mentioned the sort of 80s and 90s period where, you know, there was a decline in British manufacturing and a rise in I suppose, what was the beginnings of what we would now call fast fashion. But I think the two things that you mentioned in terms of that establishment of the military and royalty, tweed as a style, as a material, up until very recently, has been that country sports, toad of Toad Hall, a very dated reputation. But that's changed and is still changing. And what do you think's behind some of that transformation? What do you think the driver is?
I think there's people are definitely interested in heritage and provenance. I'm really trying to encourage people to think about the actual, you know, the fabric that they're wearing is so important because of its effect on the environment around us also. The idea of wearing a natural fibre like wool, as in tweed, rather than a man-made fibre like a polyester or, yeah, a fleece, is my mission, is to try and get people to realise that there's a real price we're paying on wearing man-made fibres, that every time you wash them, each fleece is releasing nearly 2 grams of microfibers per wash, which, if you think of the number of fleeces there are in the world and the amount of times people just chuck things in a washing machine without really thinking about it, that's a lot of microfibers and, you know, just plastics going back into the water supply. I think that, you know, people are becoming more aware of that. I'm trying to encourage people to embrace it for its multi-purpose. It can go anywhere. It keeps you dry. It keeps you warm. It breathes with you. It lasts for years, so long as the moths don't get it. Even if they do, then you just maybe have to get a bit better at darning and repairing. But to give you an item of clothing that's going to last a lifetime and maybe be something you can hand on to someone else, and discourage people from washing it too much. And the thing about tweed is it's waterproof because of all the lanolin, all the oils in it. The lanolin is not washed out of the sheep's wool when you weave the tweed, which is why it's coarser than other woolen fabrics. As long as you don't wash it, you don't wash that lanolin out, it keeps its water repellence. So it will keep you dry. But as I don't know if you've ever slept with a wool duvet, as you might know from that, it's an extraordinary material that can somehow keep you warm, even though a wool duvet is a fraction of the depth of a down duvet, but it really keeps you toasty in a completely different way.
The business that you've gone into, or that you've started, is something that you didn't have experience of, or hands-on experience of, in the past. So obviously a lot of that knowledge has come from just getting on and doing that. But what led you to think, okay, well, I'm going to start a fashion business?
Originally, I started doing it with a girlfriend who had lived in Kenya with me. She was French, and she and I wanted to make tweed clothes that were slightly unexpected. I mean, trouser suits, dresses, coat dresses, I mean, stylish stuff, but using tweed in slightly different ways than people would necessarily expect, slightly updating the rather fuddy-duddy old lady image of tweed, giving it a bit more granny chic. And we started, we were called Settlers Stores, and we used to have a little shop in Froome for about 3 years, tailored pieces, and definitely quite fashion. As it got close, well, as lockdown kind of happened, and Nat had decided, she as a French person married to an American, a combination of COVID and Brexit did for her, and she was like, I'm leaving. So she moved on, and I realized that what I really wanted to do was my passion for fashion was fading fast, and I just want to make workwear. I wanted to make stuff that is practical. Everything's got pockets, and it's stuff that will last you for years, but is really workwear. But because it's in tweed, it keeps you warm in a way that nothing else does. And it is obviously made on these shores, so you're keeping it all made here in Britain.
What do you find most satisfying about what you do?
I think the most satisfying thing is finding people who come to me having bought something from me, one of my working gilets or waistcoats. And this actually happened last week. A woman who bought something from me 2 or 3 months ago, coming out and going, oh my goodness, I'm so grateful to you. I never take it off. It has become my old friend. And that is what I want each of my pieces to become. They are your old friends. And it's a friend for life. And in old Somerset, it's called an acre, which is, I called the business Acre and Holt. In old Somerset, acre was spelt acre, A-C-K-E-R. But it also, acre means in old Somerset, old friend, which I didn't know. That's Acker Bilk. Apparently he was from Weston-super-Mare and he was somebody's old friend. But it's making people comfortable in clothes, making them feel good, and actually halving their microfiber shedding fleece wardrobe in one fell swoop. Combination of all of those things, I think, is what makes it satisfying.
And I think more people are considering this, buying cheap things. You know, there's a lot of negative side effects of doing that and sustaining that model of production. It's nice that even if it might be a small number of people, that the number of people is growing who are thinking, actually, I don't need to buy something new. I just need to make sure that things that I do have are not going to break, are things that I can, you know, that will last a lifetime.
I think people do really appreciate it now, and they do understand the value of buying one thing well made and that will last you. I hope so, but I have found that a lot of my customers now are people who then, and they do come back because they realise the cut works and they like what I'm making, but they like the fact that they know that it's all made here and it can also be repaired. I do offer a repair service for some of our garments, because if they do get trashed, then, you know, we can do some repair to give them an extra lifespan.
You were recently at the Chelsea Flower Show, which I suppose is quite a big event for someone in your position. So how was that? What did you get up to?
It was amazing. This May, there was an extraordinary confluence of Somerset folk. Not only did the Best in Show Garden Gold go to Lulu and Adam Urquhart and Hunt, who are based in Bruton, but there was also another wonderful garden from a girl, Lottie Dillamain, who is based in Castle Carey, who did a garden for Fash Rev, which again is all about sustainable dyeing of clothes, and had the plants underneath that grew the dyes for the fabrics that were above. It was amazing for me too. It's a really extraordinary show that puts you in front of people that you would never normally come across. Acre and Holt launched last September at the Chelsea Flower Show. And I definitely had been working, well, I worked initially with a garden designer called Marion Boswell, who worked with me in September. I designed this long waistcoat working gilet with her in mind. She has written a book about sustainable gardens that came out this March, and sustainability is a big focus for her of her garden design. But a lot of the work that Acre and Holt have been doing is geared towards people living and working outdoors, and the gardening bit is a big element of that. So this May, when we were there, I launched our new product, which again is made in Somerset, but is what I call the garden wrap, which is a garden belt, except it wraps all the way around you. So it keeps all your kidneys warm behind you, which is quite an important bit of you. If you spend a lot of time bent double outside, you know that you want to keep the base of your spine really warm. So I devised this wrap, which is tweed and leather, basically, with a holster to put secateurs, sharp bits of gardening equipment in, D-rings to hang things from. So it's my gardener's tool belt, really. But Chelsea was a fantastic opportunity to show that off, get it out there. And the very wonderful Georgie Newbury from Common Farm Flowers, who's based in Wincanton, came to do a bit of a reveal with me on the first day of the flower show. It reminds me a bit of when I was doing the cheese shows with Godminster, that the people who are close to the soil, there's a wholesomeness to all the plants, the people that are involved with the flower show and the growing. They are a really wonderful bunch of people. And it was a pleasure to be a part of it again this year.
So what else do you have up your sleeve? Up your tweed sleeve?
Up my tweed sleeve? I think definitely keep ploughing my gardening furrow. we've got a few more. Well, I think, I've got the wrap in mind for some other shows, and thinking that the wrap might also get reborn. There's no end to the possibilities of it becoming the dog walking wrap and the camping wrap. But I will be back at more RHS shows in the autumn and working on some more tweed designs at the moment as well, which is always quite a long process, because we can come up with an idea, but then we have to get the yarns from the yarn suppliers to the mill to slot it in for a weaving schedule. So there's quite a long time lead, or quite a long lead time, even what I'm trying to say, to getting a new pattern off the loom.
But it'll be worth the wait.
Let's hope so.
Zara, we're now going to play Somerset Address or Obscure Movie, which is the game where you have to guess whether a name that I'm going to give you is a place in Somerset or the title of a film that you probably haven't seen.
Okay, I'll try.
So I have 8 names, and for each of them, I'll give you the name and then you're going to tell me whether you think it's a place in Somerset or if you think it's a film. So your first name is Cat Hanger Lane.
Okay, I'm going with Address. That's a Somerset Address.
It is a Somerset Address. It's in Curry Mallet, which is just outside of Taunton.
Okay.
Next one is Lanterns Lane.
Yep, I'll go for an address.
It's a film.
Okay.
Just from last year. It's a film about urban legends.
Oh, okay. No, never heard of it.
But it only got 3.1 on IMDb, so probably not worth a watch. Number 3 is Splot.
Well, that's got to be an address.
It is an address.
Where is Splott?
Splott is near Axbridge, in a village called Weir. Or Where? Weir? I think it's Weir. W-E-A-R-E. I think it's Weir. But you never really know with some villages. There is a mere.
But M-E-A-R-E. Yeah.
This is just Weir. Yeah, this is okay. If you switch the M upside down, you get Weir. Number four is Little Birds.
That's a film.
It is a film. It's a 2011 drama starring Juno Temple.
Uh-huh. She's got all the connections, hasn't she?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm. I think her dad lives down here.
Yeah. Should get her on the podcast.
Yeah.
So three out of four so far, you're doing well. Number five is Dead Woman's Ditch.
Oh, no, I think that is a place. Isn't that quite near here? Okay, I'd say Somerset Address.
It is a Somerset Address. It's not near here. It's in the Quantocks.
Okay.
But you got the answer right, so you still got a point. All right, your next name is Cat's Ash.
Cat's Ash.
Yes.
I'll go for Somerset Address.
It is. It's in Shepton Mallet, just down the road.
Because there's a Cat Ash Inn in South Cadbury, North Cadbury, but I didn't know Cat's Ash was a place.
All right, we've got two more. Fruitvale Station.
Go for film.
It is a film. It's a crime drama from 2013, starring Michael B. Jordan.
Okay. What was its score?
I don't know, but definitely better than 3.1.
Okay.
And you're doing well, you got six. Your last one is Agrimon's Gate.
Agrimon's Gate.
Yes.
I'll go for film.
It is a film.
Hooray!
It's a 2019 supernatural thriller with a terrible IMDb score.
Are you specifically choosing ones with very bad score?
That no one's seen. That's the aim.
Hey, that's true.
You know?
Something you never heard of course.
Otherwise, it's not fun.
No. Oh.
So that's good. That's 7 out of 8.
Setting a high bar.
Pretty good. Zara, before we go, where can people find out more about you, about your company, the work you do, all that kind of stuff?
Okay, so I have a website, which is www.acreholt.co.uk. And I'm on Instagram as well. But also, you can always come and visit me in Frome, because we do make up to order, do tailoring to order. So for suits in tweeds, velvets and corduroys, we've got a workshop showroom in the annex at home. So come and see us on Locks Hill.
Very nice. We'll do that.
Yeah.
Sara, thank you so much for your time. You've been a wonderful guest. It's been really exciting. It's been great hearing your story.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Somerset Stories is a Whitstone production, and music is provided by Jezzar under Creative Commons.